Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to She Speaks Academic Muslimas. Today's episode features Dr. Fatmeh Mardi, who has her PhD in education in instructional design technology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. In this interview, Dr. Mardi focuses on something that impacts almost all PhD graduates, the disheartening academic job market. Before we begin, just a reminder to please subscribe to the podcast and leave a review. And of course, share this episode with your friends and family. Now let's turn to Dr. Mardi. Assalamu alaikum, Fatmeh.
Assalamu alaikum.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you so much for coming on and for giving me time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, yeah, of course. I'll jump right into it because I called you up for a very specific conversation, a conversation that is very near and dear to my heart. And I wanted to ask about your journey within academia and now your journey outside of academia. But let me just go ahead and begin with, what was your journey to getting a PhD in the first place?
Right. So I want to thank you for inviting me, because this is actually something that I'm working towards processing. So very recently, today being August 14th, as of August 2nd, my current position is that I'm an instructional designer in higher education. And before that, I had been a postdoc for almost 3 years. So this transition is something that I'm processing personally. And this invitation to the podcast helped me, pushed me with the timeline to really be able to narrow down some of the factors that led to me making this decision. And just in general, like, what have I been going through? So I got my PhD in 2016. And prior to that, if you had asked me, is getting a PhD in your big plan, in your 5-year, 10-year plan, anything like that, it was not. I started out my bachelor's in food industrial engineering. And by the time I was ready to graduate, we had to do an internship. I did mine at the chocolate factory. And I did not enjoy being in the lab all day and not seeing people. And I realized that my part-time job, which was tutoring, was something that I was much more passionate about, and I wanted to continue teaching and continue working with people. So I went back to the books and I got a master's in TESOL, teaching English for speakers of other languages, which was something between a teaching degree and like an applied linguistics degree. And I went into teaching in the K-12 world, sixth grade, fourth grade, all subjects, homeschooling, tutoring, again, different states, until I wanted to enter the workforce in Missouri. And I realized that I needed a teaching degree. So I got my math teaching degree in fifth through ninth and ninth through 12th. And I'm not sure whether it was a matter of timing or what it was, because I wear hijab publicly. And so exactly what the obstacles were exactly, I'm not sure. But because I needed an income, I went to the other place that I call home, which is university. So I done some doors and I got a sort of like probationary time to explore science education and working as a graduate assistant. So once I was able to prove myself and the work that I did, which I did in curriculum development and assessment, we talked about different options, and the best one was to work on a PhD while being a graduate research assistant. So that's how my PhD journey started. And throughout my PhD, I worked for the science education professor, and that was like my 20 hours. But on the side, what I actually studied was educational technology, online learning. That's what I did my dissertation in, and focusing on online learning experiences and how theory and practice and how it all comes together, and especially instructional design. So even my PhD role had a couple of things going on at the same time. Meanwhile, raising a daughter and, you know, trying to maintain a social life, and also teaching, because even though I wasn't technically on the books, I still had to teach to make sure that I build that into my resume before I graduated. And in 2016, I graduated and my son was born. For a few years, I just, maybe for a year and a half, I just taught. I didn't actually pursue a job in academia. I wasn't, you know, actively researching. I was just mostly teaching my courses.
Where were you teaching?
At the same institution. This whole story is the same institution, yeah. And so I was teaching, and I mean, you know, the science education, graduate research assistantship, I also had other positions on my PhD journey. So I had, you know, I was an online mentor, I was an instructional designer. So like on and off, I had other positions as well.
This is all at UMSL, University of Missouri at St. Louis, right?
Yes. Yes.
And so I want to ask, like, I want to backtrack just a little bit. When you were applying, like before you got into the PhD, when you were applying for teaching positions, you said, I don't know if it was bad timing or what it was, and you now have a teaching certification in your hand, but you are unable to obtain a teaching role here in St. Louis. And you said, I don't know if it was due to my hijab as well. What gave you those kinds of vibes? What were some of, do you remember any of those experiences that kind of left you feeling like, they don't think I belong?
Yeah, I mean, I clearly remember it because that was my journey in around 2012 when I got my math teaching certification. And then I circled back around in 2019 and I got my elementary teaching certificate again because I thought, okay, well, maybe going back to the K-12 world is something that would be possible. So that's with two teaching certifications. And I was not able to. The only interview that I was able to do was a diversity hiring fair. And that was just a matter of, you know, walking in and being interviewed. And so a couple of school districts like had sort of like a job fair, but it was specifically for diversity hiring. And the interviews went great. Yeah. I mean, they were really receptive. They were nice. They were welcoming, but nothing came of that. And so interesting because one of the interviewers said, you know, why do you want to come back to K-12 after being in higher ed? And I said, because I believe in catching them early, creating that academic set and that sort of like a growth mindset, but making sure that, you know, students understand that they can do it. And so, you know, as I see this sort of like a bug in undergraduate and graduate school, it's like, well, why don't we just catch it really early on and instill that strength and self-belief in them much earlier on, especially in STEM. And everything seemed fine, but nothing really came of it. So yeah, it wasn't like I hadn't explored other options.
So you complete your PhD, you then take on a postdoc. Before you accepted your postdoc, were you at the same time applying for tenure track positions?
I applied for a few things, but it didn't seem promising. And the reason was because I didn't have enough publications. Well, I should say, I believe that the reason was that I didn't have enough publications and I definitely didn't have any grants. And so I said, okay, well, I will work on my publications in the postdoc while getting experience with working with grants, because that is not a task to do single-handedly. So I got the postdoc position, and that was, so the other side of the same coin is when someone is willing to take a risk for you and to go out on the limb and really say, yes, I will hire her. And so that's how the PhD position came about in science education, is that one faculty saying, I will hire her. And the postdoc was the same, a different person, but it was the same thing. You know, he took on 50% of the expenses, so to speak, of my position, and the college paid for the other 50%. So that person risking whatever it is a faculty had to risk to come out of his endowment to pay for me to be on as a postdoc, that led to, you know, this postdoc journey. And so many of the things that I talk about, like of the difficulties of being in higher ed right now, might resonate with people who also have similar positions as postdocs. And I understand that, you know, the culture of each organization is different, but at least half of the time of my postdoc was in a pandemic. And within higher education, we also dealt with the other education sector being K-12 because we are in, we're in teacher preparation. So the College of Education is a place that, you know, has pre-service teachers and in-service teachers. And so they are also going through a very difficult time during the pandemic. So that, just to put into perspective, that a lot of these things are just postdoc related, but then specifically pandemic related and institution related as well.
Sorry to interrupt. Before you move further, I wanted to ask, you said the person who, you know, was willing to risk, and you said whatever they're willing to risk out of their endowment, I mean, obviously they needed the help of your labor. And so that is why they are hiring you. But I think the risk that you're talking about is that most professors are white. Most professors, you know, when they do have endowments, end up hiring people who look like them, people who they feel comfortable and familiar with. And times, so the, you know, the going out on the limb is them actually practicing or being self-conscious of their own prejudice in many ways and being saying, you know, I know people have that prejudice. I'm not an exception. I might have that prejudice too. So let me make sure that I'm not exercising that prejudice in my hiring practices. Because I think a lot of postdoc positions where there is such a high level of discretion involved end up going to folks that the faculty feel, like I said, comfortable and familiar with, which oftentimes translates into them affirming their racial biases and prejudices in their hiring practices. So I just wanted to like sort of bring back that point, the risk that the person is taking.
Yes.
So now you're in that postdoc position, but you're also simultaneously surviving a pandemic that impacts the nature of your postdoc and what you are doing during the postdoc. All this while, are you also applying year after year?
Yes.
Elsewhere?
So that's definitely part of my role. So to give more context, I had multiple pieces to the postdoc, and exactly what you're saying. One part, which I would say probably a good 15 hours a week, would go to an unpaid position, which is called applying for jobs. And that means resume continuously, like, you know, building on that, drafting different cover letters. But specifically for me, so I was applying nationally and internationally. And the way it works for postdoc positions and in general, just faculty positions for Europe, is that you have to write a quote unquote proposal. And so you have to research all the faculty, the, you know, college that you're applying for, the grant that they have. Most of the time they're like grant related, and they're just in general, like their mission, their vision, their values, and how you would fit into their institution. So they had, so for each of these positions, I would spend a lot of time working on, you know, really coming up with a plan and a proposal. And so each of them had entire literature reviews. They had, you know, timelines. It was almost like writing a mini grant for each of these proposals. Yes. And my countries were Switzerland, Germany, the Netherlands. So places that had like a very different culture than mine. And it was very hard to sort of really figure out, you know, what would be accepted, what is considered favorable, what piece of my life would it be good if I put forward, and which one should I hold back more? And so each of the, even the interview processes, we required a lot of time to research because of the different social and cultural differences. So, you know, to make sure that my research and my capability stands out instead of some cultural differences. So I put a lot of time and effort into those as well. And those actually did go to, you know, the interview levels and like multiple levels as well. And then the very final piece of each one was like, they hired someone locally instead of internationally. So I think in that respect, the pandemic definitely had an impact, yeah, because those would have been in person if they hadn't been the pandemic. So that was like one thing I knew. And the other one was, again, with the risk, you know, they just weren't sure if, you know, at a time the United States was in a harsher place with COVID, and they wouldn't even allow travel right. from the States into Europe. So there were a lot of factors, but at the end of the day, I think they just chose the safe local candidate for those positions. And I think that is important. So if you nationally, I only applied to 2 states. And a lot of my coworkers said, yeah, well, you know, you have to go and move and, you know, be open to moving anywhere. And they explained how one of my coworkers spent 3 years just applying to everywhere in the country. And I explained that I need to, you know, be cognizant of the individuals in my life, my parents, and also my children and my husband. So each of them have their own life plan, and whether it's, you know, friendships or careers or other family members, each of them, you know, they would have a lot of repercussions, my actions yeah. on each of them. So I tried to minimize that by just choosing like 2 states.
So a couple of things. Okay. One thing is the prep that you just talked about that goes into each application.
Yeah.
I think people outside of the academy do not realize how much is required to put one job application for us together. Like if you're like, let's say a programmer and you're applying for a programming job, you spend some time writing your cover letter to make sure it fits the company that you're applying to, their values. And then you have your generic CV and you might like make sure that it contains the buzzword that were in the job description. But beyond that, that's kind of pretty much it, right? You know, but in academia, you have to put your portfolio, your teaching portfolios, your course portfolios, you have to put up your research portfolio that requires writing samples. Which writing samples should I use that would fit their agendas and such? And then,
exactly.
you know, I mean, there's just so much involved, you know, your service portfolios, what services, like you said, should I put forward? What parts of myself should I put forward? And in academia, they expect all of you to show up. So let's say if you're a, you know, a physician, or you're a lawyer, or you're a programmer, or you're an architect, any kind of white collar job, they generally are like, okay, we require you for XYZ skills. But in academia, they're like, tell us about your person, you know, write a narrative about your person, because we're interested in the whole of you. You're like, no, you're not. I have no idea why you're making me go through this.
Exactly.
It's so frustrating.
Exactly.
Making those packets.
Yeah. And like, each time they're different. So it's not like I could reuse yeah. them. I mean, I had a baseline for some things, especially like the resume was probably the easiest, but even the resume, like, you know, there were parts where some people wanted teaching philosophies, some people wanted syllabi examples, some people wanted diversity and inclusion philosophies.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
those
were
so difficult to write.
They're very difficult, and they're very, you know, you have to be mindful of, you know, what that institute, you know, what they believe in and what they, you know, because if I, if they had asked for demonstrated, you know, activities of inclusion, I could, you know, put forward a lot of different things, but that might be too much for them, you know, and that's kind of like, in general, you know, the one of the big obstacles is I might be too much for them.
Right.
And that is something that is about my background. So like just the fact that I'm like a transdisciplinary kind of like a background where I can speak to different experiences. I can understand people coming from different places and walks of life and how they ended up in teacher education. I completely, you know, an expert like in online teaching and learning. And that I think on some level intimidated mm-hmm. some people. And that wasn't like, that isn't my goal at all, but,
and
I always
it's,
had to
and
have a
it's
job.
Something they should, yeah, exactly. You need the
so,
job.
Yeah.
It's something they should value. Instead, you have to kind of be careful. So what was that emotional journey like applying for these jobs? What were you feeling when you were getting rejections? Were you not hearing back? How did all of that impact your mental health?
So the general well-being, it was not good. So like I say, I had multiple positions as a postdoc, and then a lot of this job application time, but I also had another responsibility, which I kind of just coin it as like visibility. So whether that was getting research out there, trying to go to conferences, again, this was during the pandemic, but attend as many local or national things as time could provide, and then speaking up and being, you know, participating in committees, participating in impromptu initiatives that were taking place during the pandemic for teacher support. And then with regards to well-being, again, because, you know, there's no time in the day to do anything for yourself or even sleep. But then on top of it, what really hurt was the fact that then when it was done, you wouldn't get any recognition for it. Or right. when you were doing it, you know, faculty would pull rank in the middle of it. And then, yes. you know, they would make sure that you know your place, the fact that you are just a postdoc. Or even from higher leadership, you know, I would go with ideas and the answer would be, well, you're just a postdoc. That's a great idea, but yeah. you're just a postdoc. So
basically like you're on 24/7 yes. and every opportunity that comes up, like every email about some initiative, something's happening, right. you feel compelled. If I don't participate in this yes. thing, I'm going to miss out that one in a million chance that this could be where I get some recognition, my name out there. And exactly. that could lead to some opportunity possibly opening up for me later. So you yeah. have like this intense pressure because literally your livelihood yeah. depends on you constantly being 24/7 on unpaid labor and yeah. unrecognized completely, like you said, absolutely. Where people pull rank on you, they co-opt your work, they take credit for everything. And
well, I'm not sure if they take credit for everything, but I just mean that, like, again, with the messaging from higher leadership, it's like, all of a sudden you get an email saying, oh, this endowed professor moved something in the backyard. Let's everyone give him a hand. And, you know, and I'm like very appreciative of their efforts. And I love that that's being recognized, but it was also close to 20 hours of, you know, just planning for an event that we did for 10 weeks long. And there was no recognition. There was no payment. This was on top of something else. And the grant that my coworker got was actually to pay teachers to participate. There was like nothing in it for someone like me. But, you know, a little bit of recognition or some kind of support, even moral support, would have been nice. And the thing about it is, you know, who is in your network? So I had the person who was the sort of like department chair for half of my time there. She was sort of like a mentor and a friend. And I would just go to her with these issues that would come up with faculty where I felt marginalized, isolated, disrespected, you know, and I would just go to her and she wouldn't necessarily do anything, but just having someone, you know, to explain things to and to hear that it's not you, it's them.
You right. know, because, somebody to validate your
somebody
reality.
Somebody to validate that. Yeah. And I also, so that was one person. And then I also had, again, with the, like, not really sure about the roles because you're a postdoc, the two people that were technically my employers, but they were also like colleagues and who I worked with. They also were very supportive. And I remember a time that we had pre-pandemic, we met weekly, and of our weekly discussions, one of the faculty, they, you know, put something into action to get an idea patented, and he put all three of our names on it. And I was just in such shock that, you know, I was like, you know what, I felt like an amazing sense of, you know, I'm part of the group. He sees that my contributions and my presence is valuable. Mm-hmm. And the other colleague also helped put everything into objective, like look at everything with an objective lens, really analyze the situation, you know, offer support on the phone. And so she also helped me through very difficult times. So had it not been for those three people, I don't even think I would have made it this far. And so, I mean, those are definitely things, because it's almost like you're walking on this really uncharted territory. So even if people have, you know, tenured positions or endowments, those are from a long time ago. I've had, not only at UMSL, but from other institutions in St. Louis, I've had people tell me just flat out, literally, they would say, if I right now apply, I wouldn't get hired. Because the people coming in are so overqualified. They have so many publications. They have, you know, postdocs and research going on and grants. And, you know, they do all these different things. Like, we did not have this going in. We had this when we were going up for tenure. That's the way it is. So we basically have to, like, blindly, and by we, I mean these postdocs who are, you know, not getting an NTT, you know, a non-tenure track or a tenure track position. We just have to kind of blindly say, okay, well, how many pieces of research do you need? And nobody knows. So this, you know, when I was trying to outline the factors of me leaving, the highest one is the ambiguity of how actually to get a position. Because it seems that, you know, simply applying or filling up your resume with all these things you know you have to have, seems like that's clearly not enough. There has to be some, you know, other route where people, like, know people, or I don't know how exactly, even to this day, I still don't know how it works. And a lot of people, because they've seen my strengths, they've reached out to me and said, again, those same three supporters that I've had, they've said that, you know, it's just like a really hard time, both in Missouri and in higher education, with the, you know, the budgets and, you know, the way that things work and everything. And you have what it takes. You everything on paper is fine. And, you know, student evaluations, whatever you want to look at, it seems fine. There is no, like, red mark on it. Again, you know, you can always say, well, it might be something part of her personality, or it might be like
it literally is just the system that we exist in. It's not, you know, so I mean, and I don't know if I wouldn't say that this is all very recent, because I graduated in 2012. So it's been like 9 years. 9 years since I graduated. And I remember one of the jobs I applied to, they forgot to BCC the rejections of the first round. And it was CC'd instead, the rejections for the first round. And there were 700 PhDs applying for the same job, for the same AOS, area of specialty and area of competence. How can you have 700 people who have PhDs in philosophy? Okay, let's say even half of them didn't have PhDs. They were totally unqualified, and I don't know why they were applying, and they didn't have the AOS and they didn't have the AOC. Let's say half. Still, 350 people have a PhD in philosophy with the same AOS and AOC, or near adjacent AOS and AOC as the job advertisement. I mean, when I got that email, it really then dawned on me.
Right.
You know, it's not me. I exist in a terrible system that where there are just not any jobs. There's too much exploited labor in academia, where, like you said, they expect you to work for free. They expect you to be present constantly. All the while, student tuition is going up and our salaries stay stagnant. And if we're lucky, then they rise up with inflation. So, I mean, it's not like, oh, is there something on my resume? Do I not have enough publications? Did my syllabus not hit the right points? You know, I mean, I feel like this is like literally nitpicking based on, and often that nitpicking happens more so when you have an application of a minority versus not, because now that I'm an associate professor, and even before that, I've been on several search committees for my department, and sometimes the things that people pick up for women candidates are so ridiculous. You're just like, you're like, you didn't say that for the white male candidate. So exactly. Did you see how she didn't reference this canonical reading that is so important? Like, how can you not teach Kant if you're going to teach XYZ? And I'm like, yeah, the other guy didn't mention, you know, Nicomachean ethics, and he's talking about teaching an ethics course. So, like, why didn't you point that out? And that doesn't dawn on you until you like sometimes even leave the meeting and you're like, crap, like what a double standard. But now, yeah. Thankfully, I'm experienced. In my first couple of meetings, I didn't catch it right away. But I think after like this one blatant time, I was like, oh my God, this happens like more frequently than not. And even though I wasn't tenured, I would like speak up and say like, okay, I think something not great is happening right now. So then how did you get to this position where you were like, I'm going to apply outside the academia? What was that emotional journey like? What was that in terms of like just processing, this is not going to work out, I have to do something else?
So the biggest thing I think for me was that I would look to people who have tenure track positions or endowments, or you know, just like the best situation, you know, the people in their field know them, they attend all the conferences, they even get invited to sit in on grant applications, you know, so they're in their highest point. When I looked at their lives, they had so many things that they weren't able to do. You know, they had physical and time limitations where like one of them got hospitalized and she had to reduce her teaching load. She had to, you know, stop all her research. I mean, she got to the point where she had to prioritize her well-being. And in education in general, you know, higher ed, you know, all of those places, there's always like a sense of, well, let me just get through this semester. Let me just finish this deadline. Well, yes. Let me just finish that. And then all of a sudden you can turn around and see that these 3, 4, 5 years have passed and that let me just finish whatever never ends. And so I saw this, I wasn't able to objectively see this in my own life because I thought it was, I have small children or I have, you know, I'm also job searching, like that's the reason. Or, you know, once I get to a position where it's a, you know, like a faculty position, then I can rest. But then I noticed, no, even the people who, you know, have everything, they're still under so much pressure that there's no end to this madness. And then I realized that, you know, I like to check things off my list. I like to be the best that I can be. And I always like to make sure that I'm, you know, doing what's expected of me. So it's also not in my personality to just, you know, get to a position and then just sit back and say, okay, well now I'm here. No, of course I'm going to run through the, you know, the, you know,
hurdles
but also like a hamster, you know, it's like in a wheel, I'm going to be running and I'm not going to understand that, hey, you're in a wheel. This is never going to end. And so I know that about myself as well. So being, you know, like 10 days into this new job, I feel that I was in a closet before and it was very dark and there was not a lot of air circulation. And now somebody opened the door and said, you know what, you can just walk around. You can just, you know, so I feel like I'm still doing work. I'm still like one of my personal missions, you know, is to provide teacher support, whether that's through in-service education, you know, and teacher preparation, which I still continue to teach at UMSL, or that's, you know, faculty support, you know, in whatever position I am, I feel like I'm still doing the work that I need to be doing. But the difference is that they have things in this world. I'm just going to give you, you know, a little, reward here. They have things in this world called personal days. And it was like, what, you know, 4 days a year. That means like for however many hours, you don't have to use them as a whole day. You're supposed to do personal stuff. They have things called like renewal days, you know, to like recharge yourself. And I'm like, what are you we're not speaking the same language. I understand that's English, but that cannot be the case. Like, how does that work? And you know, it's just like everything in higher ed circles around grant dates, publication dates, and teaching and semester dates. there is no, oh, I don't feel well today. Because if you do, you're going to have all that guilt that everything is still due tomorrow. You know, that deadline isn't going to change because you right. don't feel well.
Yes.
And so that takes it away from the personal well-being of an individual. And it takes it away from being authentic and meaningful, because on some level, I feel like people are faking it, you know, because they're not okay, but everybody just shows up to meetings and, you know, oh, I'm fine. And then there's this like grind culture. Like, yeah, I'm super busy. I'm working on 5 projects. Yeah. I haven't checked my email in 2 weeks. Well, that's not good. Yeah. You know, that's our communication path. Like, you know, things people are proud of. Mm-hmm. I would stop and I say, I don't want to be proud of those things.
Right.
You know, right. I want to be proud of the contributions and the accomplishments. Like the goals are the same, but I don't want to be proud of, you know,
working I haven't 24/7.
Been able to, exactly. Yeah. yeah. And of course, with the pandemic, another thing that I saw was about the family life. So there was a huge divide between people who were the majority who didn't have kids, whether mm-hmm. they were, you know, much older and had already moved out, or they just didn't have like families like that. And so there was a huge difference of just the way that I had to hide that side of my life as, no, I'm fine, I can do this. You know, and just a general, like not understanding of what that means, like the implications of a lockdown for parents.
Yeah. And I mean, actually there's research to show that the most impacted were actually mothers.
Yeah.
Even though men were impacted as well, but I think there's, you know, the data will, you know, hopefully be more conclusive. Like there'll be replicated studies of this to make the data more conclusive. But the initial studies are showing that the hit was primarily taken by women, because they had to home, like I, at least in my household, my husband had to still be on site because he's a healthcare worker. He had to be on site for his job. And initially I was like, okay, we can do this together. You guys do your homeschooling, your Zoom class thing, and I'll do my thing. And then I realized they can't do their Zoom school. Like my kid's getting a 0 because he doesn't know how to upload something. He tried 4 times, he failed. And then he said, okay, well, I did it. The teacher wanted me to do it. So I did. I was like, no, if you don't submit, the teacher doesn't know you did it.
Right.
So I'm like, oh my God, I have to be present in doing these tiny, tiny tasks as well. Otherwise, you know, this whole schooling business is not working. And one can say, well, you know, it's the pandemic. It's, you know, but the thing is that at the end of the day, they're still assigning grades for some whatever reason. And so now my, you know, A student is sitting with a 0 and he's kind of confused. And he's like, I mean, it was just ridiculous. The amount of work that I think went into schooling kids who were supposed to be in school through their teachers. Their teachers are overworked. Their teachers are trying to get used to a brand new system of teaching. The kid doesn't know what's happening. The parent is overworked. I mean, it was like just a complete collapse with no acknowledgement of the reality we were in, which right. is that we're living in a pandemic, fearful for our lives, fearful for our parents' lives. And somehow you just pretend like, oh, everything's okay. I'm still here. So what's on the agenda for the department meeting? You're like, I'm not feeling so well. I really feel like I'm going to, you know, melt.
And when it comes to research, you know, I've also seen what you're talking about, but I've also seen specific journals share their statistics about how so many women single authored work went through during the time of the pandemic, not necessarily published, but like the initial submission. And so that was also very disheartening, because it's like, whether you are, you know, just struggling to get all your work done and your kids' work done, or when I look at those numbers, I'm thinking, okay, well, they are feeling so much pressure that they are probably going through the same things that every other woman is, but they're just really still trying to prioritize their research and get that out there, you know, so that they don't get behind, so that they don't you know, have more problems. So that also is, you know, them not prioritizing themselves and not being able to feel the pandemic the way that they want to. They have to rather focus on their research and, you know, like all the things that go through there too. So I think that at the end of the day, I wanted to feel recognized. I wanted someone to say, oh no, we need you. You know, you know what you're doing. We need you. But it didn't happen. And once I got a hire letter from the person, you know, from the institution that I'm just started working in, I took it to higher leadership and I said, well, you know, just give me a different job title. I don't necessarily need like a raise. I know we're not financially in a good place. Why don't, you know, I'm willing to stay on, just not as a postdoc, just give me a different title. And once I heard that no, I really felt like, okay, nothing is going to change. You can stay here for six more years. Nothing is going to change. Just get out. Right. So with that, just get out. I kind of feel that, so this is me talking to like a protect postdocs committee or, you know, something like that to, you know, help all those who are resonating with what I'm saying, feel that, you know, you have to personally get to the point where you have to say, okay, well, what is exactly that you wanted out of that faculty position? Right. Was it a secure, you know, way to have an income? A lot of those skills are transferable and you can get different jobs. So one of the ways that like I did that was instructional design, because of all the online learning and teaching, both training and, you know, teaching and like everything that I've been through and my research, that's all in that direction. And it's a particular passion of mine. So I was able to get this position, but there's so many other things. Like another one of the avenues that I'm doing is data analytics and data science, because especially for those PhD students or postdocs who have experience with a lot of quantitative research, those are also very, very like it has a very different job market. So if you stay in one city and you just look online, within a week, you can find at least, you know, 10 openings. And whereas for my position, very similar, I'm sure, to all positions in academia, sometimes you have to wait maybe 3 months, 6 months, a year for an opening if you're only looking at one state to open up. And even then, you're not sure how many postdocs are in line to get that position. Right. You know, and so
it seems like the initial step to start applying is the hard part. And then once you actually get that acceptance letter, you get the hire letter, you feel like a sort of a liberation. Would you say that's true, that the initial step was hard, but now that you're on the other side, how do you feel?
Yeah, it wasn't liberation at all, because it was a heartbreak. You know, I thought the opposite. I thought, you know, once I get that hire letter, that's it. Then they'll say, oh no, we don't want to lose her. Well, we're going to keep her. But that didn't happen at all. But now that I'm in the position that I am, I feel that this is a position that, you know, I wish that, like, especially those three people who had supported me so much throughout my, you know, my postdoc and my job search, I wish that on them. I wish they could get out of that closet and just experience the air and the light and freedom that the rest of the house offers. Because as long as you're in that, you know, mindset of, okay, this is due, this is what I have to do, this is what I have to do because, you know, this report is due on this time, you know, like, and I understand that every job has deadlines and a, you know, a workload, but many jobs offer weekends.
I would say most jobs offer weekends. It's funny because, you know, a lot of times people are like, oh, you don't teach in the summer, so basically you get paid for 12 months when you're working 9 months. First of all, no, I get paid for 9 months.
Exactly.
I work on a 9 month contract, but I'm working the entire 12 months, like through the summer. Right. I'm still prepping courses. I'm still researching. I'm still getting emails for service for the department, even though, okay, to a lesser degree, but they're still there.
Yeah.
So the job market as it exists now And academia in general oftentimes makes us feel like we have failed when academia has failed us in many ways.
Yes.
The other part that I want to emphasize here that I think is kind of comes out in your story is that, you know, you said you get that this hire letter and you feel heartbreak. And I think that is a testament to the mentality that we're trained with, that to not get a tenure track, but to have a job that pays your bills and gives you weekends and values you as a human being and acknowledges that you have relationships outside of work is not the barometer for your success. Staying within academy, getting that tenure track job, that's the only barometer that you should be measuring yourself by. And that, like you said, that's a hamster wheel because it never ends once you're, you know, even if you're lucky enough to get a tenure track job, then you are working to get tenured. Once you become associate, you're constantly grants, publications. I mean, it's just constant pressure to keep producing, to be on all the time.
Exactly.
But thank you so much, Fatmeh, for sharing your journey. I really appreciated it. I'm so glad that you were willing to share, because I know this journey resonates with so many people, because there are so many people that I've talked to who've gone through something similar, maybe not the same exact types of journey of postdocs and such, but the same kind of heartbreak and mental health struggles that you talk about here, because it is heartbreaking to apply for jobs in the academia. I mean, there's no software to put it. So I really appreciate you sharing your story.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me and to help me process as well.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.